Show.
Welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio Smart Camp. I have a sweater on, I'm sipping some tea because it's a little chilly today, and I hope you're keeping your tootsies warm wherever you are in the world. And I think today's conversation is going to warm your heart and bring some sunshine into your life. Today I have Zainab Johnson on Tom Rhodes Radio Smart Camp. I met her many years ago in New York City at the Comedy Cellar. She's living in LA now, and I am often on shows with her. And I love her comedy, I love her perspective, I love her voice. And she's someone I've wanted to have on the show for quite some time, and we finally worked it out. So it is my pleasure to present to you now the one and only Zainab Johnson. Hooray. Zainab Johnson, ladies and gentlemen, how are you?
I'm pretty good, Tom. How are you?
Well, first of all, I can't believe we finally got to pull this off because I was trying to have you on my podcast for years.
Yeah.
And it was always, we were like, yeah, we'll get together and we'll do it.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic hit, and then also you had flirtations with superstardom. There was a lot of different obstacles that got in.
I think I always thought you were always gone and living somewhere else. And then the past 2 years during the pandemic, I actually forgot that people existed.
Yeah. How did the pandemic affect your life as a person and a comedian?
The first year, it definitely, like, so many things got canceled that for maybe like a month, it was kind of frightening, you know, because so many really big things for me got canceled. And it was like my first time ever doing these things, you know, like, oh, my first time ever premiering, you know, having a big premiere at South by Southwest, like all of these experiences that I had dreamed of having got canceled. But then I realized that I was like tired and needed a break. And I felt like sometimes you can't take a break when you feel like the world is moving because there's like that FOMO, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, and as a comedian too, you know, you work so hard, it takes so long to get gigs and to get hot. And you were really on the launch pad
for
superstardom. You still are.
Yeah, but yeah. I'd like
you had
to
so much
so.
Going on. Once you get to that point as a comedian where like shit is going on, it's hard not to take all the work and all the offers and everything.
But you, okay, so I immediately got on board with the Zoom shows. You know, I was not one of those people like, I can't, you know. I'm like, I adapt, you know. And I did Zoom shows. They were terrible. Like some were great. I even, you know, did a few where I like headlined myself. And it was really nice to see people really wanting to show up still, you know. But the good thing that came out of it, comedy specific, is I was traveling so much before the pandemic. And whenever I felt like I needed to, like, if I wasn't on the road and I felt like, oh, I have some time and I just want to devote it to like stand up, I would just go to New York and spend time in New York and just get on stages there. And the pandemic kind of forced me to stay in LA. And I really sort of like bit my teeth into the LA comedy scene, which I had never really done before. Like, sure, I was a part of the scene, but I never really like felt like I needed it because I had New York, and New York is such a strong comedy scene, you know?
Yeah, and you're such a New Yorker, and we'll get to that in a minute. But, you know, for me, I didn't realize how bad I needed a year off until the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I could pay my rent, and it wasn't, you know, forever. I had to be on the road to make that rent and that monthly nut and everything. Yeah. And it kind of changed my perception of comedy. Like, I don't want to be relentlessly on the road like I used to be. I want to live more like a human being. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of comedians recalibrated their lives.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you were definitely on the road a lot. Somebody asked me, a comedian was, you know, it was like they love the road. They can't wait to be back on the road. And I'm like, I don't love the road. And I think that, you know, it's interesting for a comedian like me. Like when I hear somebody say, oh, I'm tired of the road, they've been on the road for 30 years, you know?
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah, I'm just like
35.
I think that the road serves its purpose, But it's very lonely.
Yeah.
You know, it's tiring. And it's like, so I realized, especially in the pandemic, because I started doing like one-nighters places, you know, because clubs weren't open the same amount of hours and things that they were. And it's like, oh, okay, we have capacity issues and stuff like this. Instead of taking a chance on a weekend, let's just do a one night, you know. And I started doing one-nighters. And I'm like, one-nighters are my jam. Like,
you mean like one night in the club? Like last night you were at the Punchline in Philadelphia.
In Philly for one night, and that was perfect.
We're not talking about shit bar gig one-nighters.
No.
We're talking about one night in a proper comedy club.
One night in a proper comedy club headlining. It could even be two shows in that night. But having to spend 4 days in a city?
Yeah.
For what?
That's the hardest thing. And that's what I don't want to go back to. Like, and then as the headliner, you got to usually, like on the Thursday and Friday, they'll have you wake up early, do these morning radio shows, and the people are trying to be funnier than you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 7 a.m., 7:30 is not a comedian's best time to be funny, you know?
Yeah.
And then as the headliner, you got to cover the check spot. You know, you're doing like an hour and all that stuff. There's just a better way to do it.
Yeah, last night when the checks dropped. So the way the show ran last night, it was the host did 10 minutes. Then two comedians went up before me. They each did 20 minutes. So by the time I get on stage, the audience has already watched about 50 minutes of comedy. And the checks dropped during a joke. And it's a joke that you have to listen to. And I thought, like, oh, do I abandon this right now? And I didn't. And surprisingly, they put those checks down and they paid attention. And I was so freaking happy about that. You know, like, I was so happy that I didn't abandon it. Like, no, I'm much more intentional when I get on stage. Like, this is what I need to accomplish up here. I have to hear how this joke sounds. I have to see what it does to the people in this club. You know, I know what it does to people in LA. I need to see what it does to people in Philadelphia. And so don't abandon it. Do it. If it survives the check spot, then that's great, you know? But yeah, that's what you have to deal with in doing like a longer set. You know, like when you're coming up as a comedian, they don't really do this in LA, but in New York, they do this where when you're a new comedian and you're trying to get past at a club, you do the check spot. You don't get paid and you go up and do the five toughest minutes, which is when they drop the checks and nobody's paying attention to you. And you do that for a good amount of time before you actually get booked.
Hmm.
I feel like I went on a tangent. I don't know how we got
there. I like your tangents. And that's quite a compliment that the audience stayed with you during that check spot, because, you know, there's a lot of times they don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember I had like a strong, dirty joke barrage of bits I would do at the end that would, you know, pummel a crowd for that check spot. You know, it's different periods, but then you want to end on a long story. And sometimes they bail on you.
Yeah, yeah. So the biggest, I was thinking about this on my flight back to LA this morning, and I realized the biggest compliment that I ever get after I perform, whether it's 15 minutes, an hour, whatever, the biggest compliment is when they either say, when I say, okay, I gotta go, and they're like, no, or when they ask me how long I was up there. Like last night, I only had to do 40 minutes. I was on stage for 53 minutes. And so many people came to me after and was like, how long were you up there? And I was like, oh, well, I only had to do 40, but I gave you guys 53. And they're like, really? It felt like 15.
Great.
When you said, okay, I'm Zainab, good night, we were like, no. That is the biggest compliment. Because, you know, you can watch somebody or even converse with somebody for 5 minutes and it feels like an eternity. You know? And so I realized that, like, yeah, I want you to laugh. I want you to say that I'm so funny. But the biggest thing is, like, that flew by for me.
That's
the biggest
beautiful
compliment.
Yeah. I think you're, I hope you don't take this the wrong way. I think there's a real beautiful sweetness to your humor. You know? You come off as really such a sweet, lovable person on stage. Like I saw you last week, and you were doing the bit about going to your gynecologist, yeah. But like, you don't want to be too easy for him, so you're playing like hard to get, or like I'm killing the bit, but
no, I'm happy that you're killing
that. You're like,
so that I can,
you don't
still
open
tell
your
it.
Legs like easy for the guy,
yeah,
because you don't want him to think you're loose.
Yeah,
I thought that was I thought that was really funny.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
And you know, the first time I met you was at the there's the Comedy Cellar, and then above the Comedy Cellar in Greenwich Village is the Olive Tree Cafe, mm-hmm. where, you know, all the comedians hang out, mm-hmm. before and after their sets. And I also find you a very beautiful woman.
Thank you.
And when I met you, you had a shaved head.
I had a shaved head.
And you were still very beautiful.
Thanks.
but you looked like really militant. And I thought it was a really cool look.
Yeah.
And I thought that was your thing. I thought that was really bold for a woman to do that. I was really impressed. And you're not, how did that affect you, and why did you stop shaving your head?
One, me having a shaved head when you met me, that was the second time in my life that I shaved my head. I shaved my head when I was 19 years old in college. I think I've always been comfortable shaving my head because my mom always did it. My mom always let her hair grow really long, and then we would come home from school and she would have a shaved head with no explanation. And, you know, I think once I started to get older, there's this, like, you know, in the world, sometimes you just don't feel like doing your hair. And it's just that simple.
Yeah.
You know? And sometimes it gets the desire to not do your hair gets so high that all you can do is shave it off. I think that, and so it's just as simple as that. For me, it wasn't like a protest. Maybe it was a protest on like another chore when getting ready, but it wasn't tied to like any sort of movement or liberation, or it was just about the chore of day-to-day life. You know?
Yeah.
Like, oh, this shaves off so much time when I'm getting ready to go somewhere.
Yeah.
This is so easy. Even moving from, you know, there's been movies and shows and conversations on end about Black women's hair. And even moving to L.A. Well,
Chris Rock made that
documentary. Yeah. Even moving to L.A., you know, it was like really culturally different in terms of how hair is done. In New York, a lot of us go to Dominicans and we go and have our hair blown out and permed and, you know, whatever. And I couldn't really find I couldn't really find the love in like styling my hair. And so I cut it off, and it was so great because it was easy. But when I did that, I wasn't a comedian. I hadn't started doing comedy yet. And so when I started doing comedy, I think the shaved head helped me because it immediately told the audience that I was fearless. Although I was scared as shit. But you see how you're like, oh my God, you just looked so militant. But it's like,
I find militancy pretty sexy, you know. Black Power Mixtape, if you ever seen that documentary on the Black Panthers, I'm a big fan of. I think it should be shown in schools, that documentary. Did you ever see that?
No. But I think that it was my protection.
Because seeing you, but what I was going to say was seeing you. And like, if I would have guessed what your comedy would have been like, I thought it would have been like kind of Angela Davis.
Yeah.
Every joke, an issue. Every joke, you know, trying to, you know, a social justice slant.
Yeah.
But now I've known you for, I don't know, 10 years, I think, and I love your comedy.
Thank you.
You as a person, and
I just think
it's really interesting that, like, because I find you to be such a sweet person, and not that you couldn't be sweet with, you know.
Yeah, I'm such a softie and a goofball, but I mean, I don't think that that's what leads. I think that that's the thing that people find out when they get to know me. But I think the thing that like leads. is like this very, whatever it is, it's a very strong presence. You get what I'm saying? It's like, it's something that's strong. And I like that because it does a lot of speaking for me. It allows me to live in like whatever you're seeing, like my sweetness. It allows me to be that because it's like already people are like, you know, what? Okay, was she about to tell us about ourselves? And then I'm like, let's talk about this, you know? I mean, I can talk about that too.
Yeah.
And I do. But I mean, that's not the totality of my life. So why would it be the totality of my comedy?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, for the longest time, I was trying to save the world with every joke. So okay. Maybe I projected that onto others also.
Okay.
But my favorite thing about comedy always, I've said it a million times, it, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, you know, it just matters if you're funny. So it really, it's this exclusive club of fighter pilots or brotherhood, sisterhood, you know, kind of thing that I've always found very attractive, that we're related in the family of comedy.
Yeah, it's like a fraternity. It's like a fraternity or, yeah. I would say that.
And your story, I mean, you're such a unique voice in comedy. You know, you're from Harlem. You grew up in Harlem.
Yeah.
I mean, how interesting to somebody.
is that interesting?
I find it really, like, just for the history of.
I mean, I love Harlem. Yeah, I absolutely love it. But I don't, I mean.
I remember you telling me years ago, like, a lot of white people had moved in and were driving up the prices. And
yeah.
I think the building you were living in.
Yeah.
Like
the building that I grew up in.
Yeah.
Yeah. My parents sold their place for $500,000.
Hmm.
And that was years ago. That was like 15 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Do they still live in Harlem?
No, my father passed away.
Sorry.
And my mom lives in Michigan.
Okay.
Yeah, she lives in Michigan. But yeah, I was born in Brooklyn and I grew up in Harlem. And I always feel like that's where my heart is, you know, always. And I think that it's a cool place, but I don't know if it's like, you know, when some, I don't know if to be from any American city is interesting to me. You know, like if somebody is like, if you were like, yeah, no, you know, I'm from Guam. I would be like, oh, that's interesting. But like, if you were like, you know, I'm from Philly or I'm from Tampa or fill in the blank with an American city, it's like, yeah, that's, we're Americans. We're from cities here.
Yeah.
So when somebody's like, so you're from Harlem, that's so interesting. And I'm like, really? A black person from Harlem? Like, what's interesting about that?
Okay, number one, you don't have that thick New Yorker accent.
Okay.
Which is very commendable on its own.
I think I do, though.
Nah, I don't think, you know, hey, yo, what the fuck, right?
No,
hey,
because
tough
that's,
guy. You don't have that at all.
But that's not a Harlem accent. That's more like a very specific area in Brooklyn, Staten Island, Long Island. And I think that like on television, they make you feel like that's what a New Yorker sounds like, but no.
I grew up in Florida with all these New Yorkers who had moved there.
Yeah,
so it was always that kind of.
But they were also what, white probably? Maybe like Italian or Irish descent, right?
Mixed, yeah.
Mixed?
Yeah.
But like, because I mean, no, even on TV from the 60s, whenever you portray a New Yorker and they're black, they're not like, hey, what are you doing? Like, that yeah, is a okay. Very white
okay.
trope.
Yeah.
On, you know, New York trope. So I feel like I sound very much like a New Yorker.
Okay.
But see, that may be like my... Me never wanting to, like, I get a little bit offended if people are like, oh, really? You don't sound like you're from New York. I get a little bit like, don't try and take my roots from me.
Okay.
So.
All right. You have a very New York accent. I think it's the history of entertainment that I think is so sexy about Harlem. You know, the jazz. I'm really into Miles Davis
yeah.
and Charlie Parker and, you know, read biographies on them. And and you're Muslim,
yeah.
So, and were you? Was your family a Nation of Islam or?
Not really. My dad did convert under the Nation of Islam.
Okay.
He did, yes. But in our masjid that we attended, mosque, was definitely a Nation of Islam mosque. It started out, it's Masjid Malcolm X, which I think was like Temple 7 or something like that. But by the time I'm the fifth child. By the time I was born, my father was no longer like in the Nation of Islam. I think that he had a, maybe an epiphany, or just a realization that there's a way to practice Islam and there's a way to be pro-Black without being in this organization, you know? And so, yeah, he started out that way, but that's not, we weren't really raised that way.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm really into Malcolm X.
Me too. I love Malcolm X.
I've got his speeches. I've got two vinyl records, and where I lived in San Francisco years ago was a Black neighborhood, and I there was a kiosk that sold like reggae, bootleg reggae stuff, and Malcolm X tapes on cassette. I still got like three of them.
Really?
And they're all still relevant.
Sometimes I bet. I mean, I quote Malcolm X so much. Sometimes I go down a rabbit hole on YouTube, like I don't mean to, and I'll watch one thing, and it's like now I'm like 2 hours in just watching Malcolm X speeches, interviews. It's almost scary how relevant they are.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, I like him. Man, he was cute too, so.
What's your favorite Malcolm X quote?
If you, and I'm probably going to misquote this, but something along the lines of, if you educate a woman, then you educate a generation.
Okay.
It's something like that. But it's basically saying like the power in putting, and this is after his pilgrimage, because you know Nation of Islam was very much not that women couldn't be educated, but it was very much men first and men do they a very much submissive subcult, you know, like Islam is already very masculine led, and so, and then the Nation of Islam, you know, further portrayed that because they're trying to re ignite the power in a black man, you know? And so Malcolm X then, you know, goes on his pilgrimage to Mecca, and he has this new education, this newfound understanding. And it's like, oh, if we pour into our men, we'll get this small result. But if we pour into our women, we'll get this much more impactful result. That's essentially what the quote is. That's essentially what he's saying, because the women are the ones who are teaching all of us, you know?
So, yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
Did you know Malcolm X, when he was in Boston, there was a guy he used to run around with, and both of their nicknames was Red.
Really?
And that friend was Red Fox.
I thought you were going to be like, and that friend was me. Really?
I used to hang out with Malcolm. Yeah. I wasn't born yet, I was there in spirit. No, it's something I read not too long ago.
Really?
That him and Red Fox were friends when they were younger.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
One of my ex-boyfriends, his favorite comedian is Red Fox. And he's like a young guy, even younger than me. And so I thought that was very interesting that his, his goat was Red Fox.
I love Red Fox.
Yeah, yeah.
I grew up with Sanford and Son, and then as I became a comedian, I discovered his stand-up.
Yeah.
Do you want to lay my favorite Red Fox joke on you?
Sure.
Okay, there's an album. I have it over here.
Okay.
It's called You Gotta Wash Your Ass.
Okay.
And on the cover is... it's the backside of a donkey, and with one hand, Red Fox is holding up its tail, and with his other hand, he's holding his nose.
Okay.
And on this album, he says, I went to Tijuana, Mexico, and I rented a car. And I was driving around and I accidentally ran over this guy and I killed him. So I was in court. And the judge said, "Mr. Fox, did you see the man standing in the street with his tamale wagon?" I said, "Your Honor, I didn't even notice that his fly was open." Don't feel like you have to laugh.
I don't. Is the tamale wagon
the tamale wagon?
Oh, his tamale wagon.
With his tamale wagon.
Yeah. I knew it was like a play on.
It's all sexual innuendo. With red.
I watched one of his specials where he's it's like he's like taking all that time to light that cigarette. I might be his only visual special.
Okay.
And Red Fox is somebody that's interesting to me because, like, on his special, like, I feel like I'm looking at, like, a 60-year-old man, but really he was, like, 42.
Right.
And I just think the people of that time, I know that sounds crazy for me to say, but, like, people of that time just looked older than what, when I watched, recently I watched on Amazon the Fat Tuesday documentary, and they cover, why is his name? Robin Harris. And
I love Robin Harris.
The first thing that I ever saw about
Bebe's Kids.
Bebe's Kids, and I knew him from House Party, you know? But it's like, I'm like a small child when those things came out. And so everybody's going to look much older to me.
Yeah.
But even looking back at that, and when they talk about historian, like he died at 38, I'm like, wow, that doesn't look like a 38-year-old person to me. You know, like the way he look has changed so much. Why was I saying that? Anyway, I watched this like 45-minute special on Red Fox, which my ex at the time, he was like, "You have to watch this. This is comedy gold." And I just like watched it and could appreciate it, but I was not laughing. I was like,
and you looked at the boyfriend differently after that?
No, I didn't because I didn't, but because I know humor is subjective, but I just also knew he was speaking in a way that is just unfamiliar to me and just not really my cup of tea, you know?
Well, Red Fox is important historically because he popularized the comedy album.
Yeah.
Before Red Fox, and I have a bunch of them. They're these party records, they were called. And people would actually at cocktail parties in the 50s and 60s, they go, "Okay, everybody shut up. We're gonna put on a Red Fox record." Mm-hmm. And so you can picture people at a house party and everybody's like smoking with cocktails and they would put on a record and everyone would listen to mm-hmm. it. So that's how comedy records, I mean, this is according to Cliff Nesterhoff's book, Comedians, mm-hmm. that's the historically significant thing that he did.
I mean, that's amazing, and I have a lot of respect for Rick. You know, like, it's like, you know how you could watch something and learn, but it's just like, I'm not laughing at this, but I'm learning, you know, like,
yeah,
I'm
learning. Yeah, well, like, you look at a lot of Richard Pryor's specials, they don't have the same impact or power that they used, because we've seen so many comedians imitate Pryor's style.
Yeah.
But at the time, that was dangerous. Nobody was talking about race like that and his experience.
Yeah.
But my father, Richard Pryor, was his all-time favorite comedian.
A friend of mine, Keith Robinson, you know Keith Robinson.
Yeah, of course.
He was, because my favorite comedian, the first comedian I ever saw was Eddie Murphy. And I not that I ever saw him live, but you know, most of us see
Delirious.
Raw.
Yeah.
I didn't even see Delirious.
Oh.
I saw Raw. And then a friend of mine was like, when I was like a teenager, I'm like, yeah, I saw this thing called, you know, like this old album called, I mean, old movie called Raw. And I'm like, it's my favorite thing. And he was like, oh, you got to see Delirious. And that's how I saw Delirious, like a couple of years late, you know, a couple of years after I saw Raw. But, and still Raw, because it was my introduction, Delirious, like I understand why Raw came after Delirious. You know, Delirious only makes Raw funnier to me, but it doesn't make Delirious funnier than Raw, if that makes sense. But it's just because
Delirious
got
so many classics, and then
it
Raw.
Does.
I remember seeing that in the theater when it came out, and I thought like, okay, he's really kind of talking from a super rich famous
place.
Guy's perspective now with the, you know, Bill Cosby tells him not to use the S word.
Yeah.
He calls Richard Pryor.
Yeah, he's talking about half. He's talking about divorce and getting half and all of that. I'm just saying, but that was my intro, so that's like the, you know.
Yeah.
But I was telling Keith was like, oh, if you like Eddie, then you'll love Richard. Richard is the reason why we even have Eddie, you know. And so I go and I take long walks and I'm just listening to Richard Pryor albums. And I'm like, I get it.
Yeah.
But I don't get it. Yeah. But then a couple of like years ago, I was listening to like Richard Pryor. Things change when you're a comedian too, when you understand.
Yeah, and you start thinking about the mechanics of the joke and the structure.
Yes.
Yeah.
It changes a lot. I find myself cracking up at Richard Pryor now, like cracking up surprisingly, like not like, oh, I'm surprised that I laugh, but like it takes over me, you know? So before I started comedy, way before, like a couple of years before I started comedy, Chris Rock came out with whatever special he had, and it was that dentist joke was on it, where he says, you know how rich you got to be as a black man to live in my neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but white people, they're dentists, they're lawyers. You know what I'm saying? If you a dentist and you black in my neighborhood, you invented teeth. I remember my friend watching it, and I was like just laying in a bed, and I could, like, I wasn't in a deep sleep. And so I heard the joke. Now, this is a couple of years before I started doing stand up. And I heard the joke, and I was like, ugh. And he hit it so hard. You got to invent teeth, you know? And I was like, oh my God, he sucks. Like, that's what I was like, oh my, it's like, come on with the joke, right? The moment, maybe like a year after doing stand up, I listened to that joke again and I was like, it's a fucking brilliant joke.
Yeah.
It's freaking brilliant, you know? And I just couldn't appreciate it before I understood what it takes to...
Well, sometimes you never know what kind of mood you're in. And when you listen to something or read a book or, or listen to an album, you know, sometimes you're just not in the right place.
I never appreciate everybody. I mean, people loved Chris Rock. I never appreciated Chris Rock until I became a comedian.
I love Chris. I didn't like him when he was younger because he was young and cocky and arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm about the same age as him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also young, cocky, and arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I think I saw, like, this is like Chris before he did SNL and a little after that. But from Bring the Pain onward,
mm-hmm.
I love Chris Rock. And that last special he did, Tambourine,
mm-hmm.
talking about his porno addiction, mm-hmm. and like how he fucked up his marriage,
mm-hmm.
just the raw honesty of it. And like, you know, I love comedy that improves your life, where people like talk about real shit. And like, I mean, I was almost frightened when he was talking about how honest he was about pornography, mm-hmm. and like, I think that's like a health crisis that's not addressed in mm-hmm. this country,
mm-hmm.
you know? I absolutely, I love Chris. I don't think...
I brought him up last week at the Comedy Store.
I saw he's been... Yeah. I haven't been there. Only on social media have I seen that he's been doing sets there.
No, I said, and I stayed and I watched. I actually had a friend's birthday party to get to, but I was like, no, let me stay. And I always feel like it's like class, you know? Like if you get to see one of the goats do it, then you should stay and learn.
Oh, absolutely. You know? And that's another thing I love about Chris. I've seen him through the years at the Comedy Cellar in New York or the Improv in LA or at the Comedy Store working on the material.
Mm-hmm.
It's great to see somebody working on the, like, I've seen him sit on stools with like a pad of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then later you see he's a fire-breathing dragon on stage, like, you know, moving fiercely on stage, doing the same material, but it's worked out. And then when he hosted the Oscars 5-6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
he was at the Comedy Store every night working on that monologue that he did at the Comedy Store.
At the Oscars.
And it was sloppy on Monday, Tuesday.
Yeah.
And Wednesday, he's like, oh shit, you know.
Yeah.
Is he going to do this? And then he'd be like, he had a couple of his writers in the back room like, hey, Charlie, what was the other, whoever, you know, what's that other thing? And then the guy would yell the premise and he worked on it. But it was so beautiful to see him hone that over a 1 week period, and then to watch him host the Oscars, and it was polished and tight and he killed it.
Yeah.
So it's great seeing brilliant comedians, how they put the work in.
Yeah, yeah. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Red Fox, did you see this documentary that came out last year? It was about the Harlem Cultural Festival. What was the name of that? Oh, God. And it happened in 1969, the same year that Woodstock happened, in the summer.
Was it presented by, what's the drummer?
The guy from the Roots.
Yeah. I have not seen, I know what you're talking about,
but
I haven't
seen it. Oh, my God, it's brilliant.
Really?
And then all you ever hear about the summer of 1969 is Woodstock gets all the press. But the mayor of Harlem put on this cultural festival of Harlem, and in this, I don't know what the big, there's a big park there.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the top of Central Park. There's got to be another huge park up in Harlem.
Yeah,
right?
There's Marcus Garvey Park.
That must be it.
I wonder where it was at. There's.
So like every weekend, there was this massive show, and the mayor of Harlem was like the MC of it.
Mm.
And Stevie Wonder, Gladys Knight and the Pips. And then there was a clip of Red Fox going there hanging out, which is what reminded me of it.
Really?
Because somebody asked him, I think it was about something like, it was 69.
Did he pass?
Who? When did Red Fox pass? I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. But it made Woodstock, I mean, this was incredible.
I'll watch it.
It was great.
Yeah. There were a bunch of ads up around LA, like billboards advertising it. So I know exactly what you're talking about. Where is it on? Is it on Netflix? Is it HBO?
I saw it on the plane. A couple months ago, and I couldn't believe I'd never heard about this thing. And so it was like every weekend over this course of a summer.
Mm-hmm.
And wow, it's really great.
I'll check it out. I will check it out.
Okay. What, do you have any relatives still in Harlem? Do you ever go back there?
Yeah. All the time I go back there, and I have two brothers that live there. Two younger brothers that live there still. And I still have, like, aunts and uncles and cousins all around New York. Mm-hmm.
So what about being, so you're like in the middle of 13 children?
I'm fifth. I'm fifth from the top, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yep.
I mean, I'm from a four kid family. I thought that was a lot.
I mean, it is. It is these days, especially. But I mean, you don't meet many people who come from really large families. Last night, I was talking to this comedian who hosted the show, and she said that her father had 20 kids. And I was like, same mother, same father. Because, I mean, it's something to have a lot of kids. But to have a lot of kids from one man and one woman, that's really the, like, over. You know, that's always the cherry on top. Like, whenever I say, I'm one of 13, people are like, what? Yeah. And then I'm like, same mother, same father. They're like, what? You know, like, that's the thing. So when she was like, my father has 20 kids. And I'm like, oh, really? Same mother. And she's like, no, he has 10 different. He had two kids with each woman. And so he has 10 different, children's mothers, baby mamas.
That's a lot easier to do.
that's
keeping
really
a healthy relationship with one person.
Yeah. You know, living in a house with 15 people at one time, that's a lot.
So were you the funniest? Because, like, it's an interesting thing. I know Brian Regan and a couple other comedians who are pretty famous, and then I've met like some of their siblings who I thought was much funnier than So do you have like siblings that are funnier than you?
I don't know. I think that they all think they're funnier than me.
Okay.
Yeah, I think
How's she making a living at this?
Yeah, I think that they definitely think that they're funnier than me. And I think that that's funny. You know, I think that you guys are a lot of you have talents that I don't have, but my talent, which is the one you need, is fearless. So, you know, you could be funny, but can you do it in front of hundreds of people, thousands of people over and over and over again? Can you keep doing it when every day you're told no multiple times? Can you still get up and do it? That's a talent in and of itself that no one talks about.
What are some of the most difficult things you've overcome in your career that you're willing to talk about?
I think, you know, I mean, it's like, I feel like I don't have like the horror stories that some people have, unfortunately. But I mean, I'm a black woman in America, you know, and comedy is just a subset. It's just a subset of American culture. And so if you think that black women are treated unfairly or looked over or unprotected in this world, then also know that it's the same in comedy. And so in order to stand out, you have to be special. You know, you really do. And I think that I hate to say this because this sounds really vain, but I think the world is actually more comfortable with black female comedians being fat and telling them what to do and being aggressive, you know, and I mean that in their performance, you know, being raunchy. I think that they're more comfortable with that than my sort of like easy presence, you know. I think that the audience has a lot to overcome watching me, because I'm not, as much as it's changing and I love that it's changing, but I'm not typically what you would imagine when you imagine a stand-up comedian, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's overcoming that. But I mean, in this business, that's like stand-up. That's like specifically stand-up. I think in this business, I think it's like every day you get rejected. Every single day.
Yeah.
Every day you get rejected. Every single day. And they reject you so polite. Like, I mean, I have never in my life heard more. I'd rather like, no, we didn't like her. She fucking sucks. No.
Yeah.
Because then you feel like you could work on something, right? You feel like, oh, okay, all I got to do is get better. But when it's always, oh my God, we loved her so much, but no. Yeah. Oh my gosh, she was absolutely fantastic. Amazing. But no, thank you. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't even know what to do with that. Except focus on not slitting my wrist. You know?
Please don't.
I mean, I'm just saying, like, it's so easy. It's so much easier if somebody's like, you know what? She's not funny. Then you're like, okay, all I got to do is go get funny. Or if somebody's like, no, she's just not talented. No, she doesn't have the look. No. Then you feel like there's something for you to do. But when they're like, I mean, it was great. But no.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you're not leaving me with anything to do except work on eating this rejection. That's really the only work I can do is like, I mean, I'm going to stay good. But also, it's like, okay, I just have to learn how to deal with no. And like the nice, a very complimentary no.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, that I always say that everything about show business is designed to hurt your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
But that is one thing you learn in the South, is people say the shittiest things in the nicest possible way.
Yeah.
So I guess that's a good prep for
the
life in show business.
But I ain't from the South. I'm from New York, where they tell you exactly how they feel, when they feel it, and don't spare your feelings, you know. And so that sort of communication I can get with. If somebody is like, no, we asked you, we needed you to do this, and you didn't do that. This is how we wanted you to show up, and you didn't show up in that way. And so it's a no. Next time, show up the way we need you to show up. Then it's like, oh, shit. All right. Well, you know, that's a pill that I got to, you know, but it's just, but like what can we say? You're fantastic.
Yeah, well, hey, there's nothing to work on there, right?
I mean, that's what I'm saying. There has to be something to change. There has to be something to change the no, you know, but you're not giving it to me.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that's been like the biggest thing for me to deal with. And sometimes you go through a lot. Sometimes it's not as simple as like a one a one-step rejection. And by that, I mean you go through some, like, let's say in television, right? There's so many steps to, like, being on TV. It's not like you just show up to one audition, right? And so the closer you get, the more invested you get into it, right? The higher your expectation is. And then it's like, okay, so I did it for you. Then I did it for your superior. Then you brought in your producers. Then you brought in your directors. Then you brought in your network. And everybody's like, oh my God, that was great. But you guys still said no?
Yeah.
Well, who'd you say yes to? Now I got to watch them and, you know, and not do the, that is really the biggest work. And I think that this is not something that a lot of people talk about, like, really, like, working to remain, like, who you are, like, keep, like, your essence when a lot of the subliminal is, like, change, change, change. As much as we live in a time right now where there's, like, individuality and us being ourselves is at an all time, the promotion of it is at an all time high, but really it's not, you know, like at the essence of it, it's not. It's like, we still want you to fit in this box, you know? And so I think the emotional work is the biggest thing I've had to overcome. Once you able to pay your bills and stuff like that, it's the emotional work.
To keep yourself mentally strong from letting mentally and emotionally. How you feel about yourself.
Yeah, because it'll do a number on you, especially as a woman.
Oh, yeah. I always say you got to be your own Bundini Brown.
Mm-hmm.
That was Muhammad Ali's corner man.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be that voice inside your own head saying, get off the ropes, champ.
Yeah.
Get up, keep jabbing, keep sticking.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be your own best corner man inside your own head.
Yeah.
Because, so much will defeat you.
Yeah. I'm referencing my ex again, and it's only because everything I know about boxing outside of Rocky movies is because of him. And he would always call that the phasation coach.
The what?
Phasation coach. It's like you need somebody. That's that person in your corner, like Dundee, that's like, you know, you got it, champ.
Yeah.
You got it, champ. Always need somebody. To get, and when you don't have somebody, you got to be that for yourself, you know?
Yeah.
So
how do you like life in Los Angeles and, you know, it seemed like leading up to the pandemic, you're on the show, what's it called, Upload?
Upload, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is that?
Upload is a half-hour comedy created by Greg Daniels, who created The American Office and Parks and Recreation. And it's an Amazon original, and it's a show, it's a sci-fi comedy about like technological advances in like the near future, and the biggest one being you can upload into a virtual afterlife. Instead of possibly dying, you can upload into a virtual afterlife. I play one of the angels, we call them on the show, customer service angels, because, like, really I'm a customer service agent, but in this afterlife I'm considered an angel. And it's, you know, at the essence of, like, most comedies is a love story. You're trying to see if these two people are going to get together. And so that's what we're watching. But then there's a lot of, like, comedy. There's a lot of commenting on capitalism and corporations and what that looks like in the future, what that looks like in the near future. Yeah, but it's a pretty good show.
And it's still running. You're in your second season?
The second season premieres March 11th.
Nice.
The first season premiered during the pandemic. It premiered May 20, I forget what specific day, but it was May 2020. And then we taped the second season during the pandemic. And yeah, the second season premieres March 11th. So I'm excited for people. I mean, that's in a few weeks. I'm excited for people to see it. I can't wait for people to see, you know, how we elevated.
Do you see yourself ever going back to New York? Or are you fully invested in getting all the acting work and...
No, I'll go wherever, like, my career takes me. You know, like, I would love to, I do see myself owning property in New York. I don't know if I necessarily need to. I've always seen myself as somebody that was bi-coastal. And so right now, it's like if I needed to pick up and work in New York tomorrow, I could. But I've always seen myself as a person that owned properties in multiple places. I'd like to own a place in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You know? But where I'm at, like, I really love what I do. I love performing. I love television. I love films, you know. I love connecting with people in that way. I love pretending. I love using my own voice, you know, in stand up. And so I'm going to do it as long as possible. And it's taken me around the world so far. So I'm going to let it keep doing that.
What are some of the interesting places you played around the world?
I did Seychelles.
For that Saudi prince.
Yes.
I did that gig. And it's weird. You never see the guy.
They told me, they said, do not look at, you know, if he talks to you or whatever, don't look at him.
To go to the Seychelles Islands.
It was. And I was like one of only two women that did it.
Yeah.
And they didn't want me. They had to be convinced to have me. But then once I got there, it was like, how did we never have her?
Yeah.
You know? But I couldn't talk about being Muslim at all. I was like, no, but I say like good things. And he was like, no.
Yeah.
No. Muslim women here do not do what you're doing.
Yeah, so you're playing for a Saudi prince and his harem.
Yeah.
And I was imagining before I got there, okay, a Saudi prince and his harem. Wow, there's going to be like just really exotic Arabic women in the audience. But it was all white women from the United States and England.
So for me, for my show, it wasn't.
Really?
For me, it was like all of like the most beautiful women from around the world. Like, but very few dark women. Very few, like, I don't, like, if they were from the continent of Africa, then they weren't the darker skinned women. But like, really, I didn't see very many, if none Americans, American women, or just like plain white women. No, that not for the show that I did.
Okay. Yeah. Because when I did.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I did it with April Macy.
Yeah.
And April destroyed the place. I did okay. But and April, she was doing crowd work.
Yeah.
And it was, most of the women were from England and the United States.
Yeah. I did really well too. I went with, I forgot the guy that I went with. Why am I forgetting his name? But I did, there was a guy in the audience. It was, of course, like 95% women. And then there was a guy in the audience. And he said something, you know, like something, not derogatory, but something like flirty. Like, you know, almost tried to reduce me up there as a performer to just like an attractive woman, you know? And I just roasted his ass. And they loved it. Like, to the point where I couldn't even go back to my material. I just had to keep freaking roasting them, you know? But yeah, so I did Seychelles. I've been to Melbourne. I've been to
Abu Dhabi. Did you do the Melbourne Festival?
Oh, yes. That was wonderful. One of my best experiences.
That was one of my best. I did that in the year 2000, and that was one of my favorite comedy experiences.
I did it in 2018, and I was supposed to do it again in 2020. And I was so flattered that they invited me back because they typically... You know, you typically go, I went as the American headline, on an American headliner show, and then you come back and do your own like 1 hour show.
Yeah.
But they invited me back to be on the American headliners again. And it was canceled because of COVID. I did Abu Dhabi. I've
played Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, I've played Abu Dhabi.
And Dubai.
I've not played Dubai, but I actually had a call with a comedian producer there this morning, actually, when I was on my way from the airport, and they were asking me to be a part of Dubai's comedy festival. So maybe this year I'll play Dubai. It'll be shortly after Ramadan, so that'll be nice. That'll be like a nice trip if I do.
Have you ever taken the Hajj?
No. I was looking into it this year. Yeah, I was looking into it this year, and I realized that I was way behind. You really have to do, like, planning, like, even the application and stuff like that. My paperwork would have been in, like, by January, you know? Like, it's not, you have to get permission. And so I didn't realize that it was that intricate, you know? So Maybe I'll do it next year, but I do plan on doing it in a very near future, in an upcoming year. Like, if not next year, like probably next year. Yeah.
Cool.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially while, because when it happens, I think it happens like maybe around Ramadan or after. It's like it'll be good to do it while it's in the while Ramadan is in the cooler months. You know, sometimes the Hajj is like in the summer, like it's so hot. I mean, I guess it's hot in Mecca all year round, right?
Yeah, but I think there's some months that
are not like 100. Yeah, you know? When I was in Abu Dhabi, I mean, the temperatures are like 115. Like, we had to travel underground for everything, unless it was nighttime.
Yeah, I remember the driving from Dubai to Abu Dhabi, and there was the wind was blowing sand across mm-hmm. the highway.
Mm-hmm.
It's really. And then there's no, the billboards advertising along the highway were of the king of mm-hmm. United Air. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm like, why doesn't the guy just get a Facebook page?
I remember because I did drive for one night from Abu Dhabi to Dubai. A friend of mine is a DJ in Dubai, and he they were like, him and his wife were like, you know, telling him like, oh, okay, this is his first wife's compound. This is his third wives comp, and I'm just like, this is all too much for me.
How is it for you acting? Did you study acting, or is it just comes natural?
I've studied a little bit, but I mean, I think I'm definitely not as comfortable with it as I am doing stand-up, you know, but stand-up has really helped me with acting because it has allowed me to, I don't know, now I know myself. I know myself as a performer, you know? But I mean, I have a lot of anxiety around acting, but I love it, you know? But I wouldn't say I'm like a trained Juilliard, you know, actress. But of course, I've taken acting classes. I've gone to like acting school, you know? But I wish that I knew that I would be doing this because I would have, instead of spending 4 years in school to get a degree in math, I would have, you know, math and education, I would have gone and studied
more acting. Yeah. I think every comedian should take acting classes when they're younger. That's a great piece of advice.
Yeah.
You're a math whiz or?
No, I'm not a math
You're
whiz.
You're a math major?
I did major in math and education. I just wanted to teach high school, and you have to choose a discipline, and so that's how I got math. And I was always good at it. I was always, or should I say, not afraid of it.
Okay.
You know, because like a lot of people, it's not that they're not even good; they're so afraid of like numbers and computing that you know. But I was just never afraid, and so yeah, it doesn't really service my life in any way. You know.
Hmm. Because that was always my weakest subject, was math.
Yeah.
And I think it was like 20 years ago, there was a talking Barbie. And there was this big uproar of criticism, backlash, because one of the things she said was, math is hard. And everybody thought, oh, why are you, it's not good for, you know, why are we, you know, projecting this onto women and young girls? And I couldn't understand why everyone was so upset about it because math is hard.
Yeah, math is hard, but it's hard for everybody.
She was speaking truth. So, how do you envision your future with showbiz, and where do you want it to go? You want your own show? You want to start movies?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely want my own show. I want to be able to sell out theaters with my stand-up. And I just want to have like a really, I just want to be able to tell like the stories that I want to tell, you know? And I want them to, and I want for a lot of people to see them. I don't just want to tell the stories, but I want a lot of people to see them. And I just want to be proud of like my legacy. Like when I'm done in the conversation of comedy, I definitely want to be there, you know? And I don't want to be like an unsung hero, but I just want it to be cemented. Like, no, this is, this is somebody that you can't talk about comedy without mentioning. That's what I would like.
You want to leave a respected body of work.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's good. Yeah. What is the greatest advice you've ever been given for comedy?
This sounds really simple, but Tiffany Haddish said this to me one night years ago. She was like, have fun. If you're having fun, they'll have fun. There's never a time where you're going to be having fun and they're not having fun. And I actually find that to be very true.
I do find that true, too.
Yeah.
If you're going through some shit and you're in a bad mood or troubled, it can be a struggle. But if you're in a great mood and you're happy to be there, it's almost impossible not to have a good set.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can think of a lot of times where it wasn't fun for me, but it was fun for them. Because, you know, when you do it often enough, you can go into autopilot and the car still gets there, you know? But I can't think of one time where I had so much fun and they didn't also have so much fun.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that's been really good advice. I think what helped me really quickly kind of get into like my voice when I first started, Keith Robinson told me, he was like, all right, if you're going to be a comedian, you got to know everything. He was like, so you got to watch the news. You got to know everything.
That's what I always thought the approach should be.
And I knew from the moment he said it that I couldn't know everything.
Yeah.
And so I was like, all right, I'm not going to know everything, but I can know everything about me. And so I'm only an expert on myself. That's how I go on stage.
That's probably a better way to do it, because I was good friends with Mitch Hedberg.
Mm-hmm.
He never looked at the newspaper. He never looked at the news. And he never read a book.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw him reading anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost like he was trying to keep his brain pure.
Yeah.
And I always thought, like, I always checked the news before I got to the club in case something big in the world happened so I wouldn't be caught off guard.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm trying to take a break. Like, I'm trying to keep the news out of my life right now, and because I very seldom ever get a joke out of it.
Yeah. When I go to different cities, I'll, like, read their news or I'll find out, like, what's happening in the city. And that's only if I need a quick way to connect with, you know what I'm saying? That's just, like... But I care what's happening in the news, but that's, I don't want to write a joke that has a time limit on it.
Expiration.
And the news has it. Yeah. There will be something in the news tomorrow. Yeah. And so I'll have to let this joke go.
You listen to the Dick Gregory records now, or Mort Saul, these guys who were doing political stuff. I'm sure, like, the Chicago bus strike was really important in 1968, but, like, now, it's, people have no idea what it's talking about.
Yeah. So, yeah, I like to, sometimes it's good to be aware because you have references, you know, but you can reference something that may help somebody understand in that moment a joke that you are working on, you know, but I never... I'm just not one, you know, the people who have to read the news every day, you know what those comedians are? Those are the comedians that don't get up and perform. They write the late night joke. They're in the writers.
Yeah,
that's their job.
Yeah.
You know, Eddie Murphy didn't get delirious or raw or not from looking at the newspaper.
Yeah, thank you. Wow. You just opened up the sky for me.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
What joke have you written that you're the most proud of?
The jokes that I'm most proud of, they always get the reaction. Like, the crowd doesn't laugh, but sometimes they're my favorite joke. So, on HBO, I told a joke, it was when I first started growing my hair back. And I wrote this joke about, I was like, yeah, you know, and I shaved my head. Everybody was like, you know, why'd you shave it? You know, you had so much hair. Why? And I was like, but then those same people, when I started growing it back, were like, no, it looks so great. Why are you growing it back? And at the time, there was I mean, it's always like this, but at the time it was definitely like a lot of shootings. It was like the Trayvon Martins. It's a lot of that happening and a lot of that on the news. And so my answer to them saying, why are you growing your hair back? I was like, because I don't want to be mistaken for an unarmed black man. And so, that normally gets like, it's normally goes from like, ha, 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 to, oh. But for me, I just felt like it was so of the time. And I was saying so much with one sentence, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not an easy joke. And it's a joke that you have to be like, I guess it's the joke that you would think that I would tell when you met me with a shaved head.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Right now, there's this really fun thing that cracks me up that I'm doing on stage. It's so small, but it cracks me up every single time I do it. It's when I'm at the OBGYN and I'm saying that I'm doing this act out of her, like looking, you know, at my lady parts.
Yeah.
And the way I do it the first way is how she does it. And then I'm like, no, you got to do it this way. And it's kind of like a play on like the size of, you know, the vagina. I mean, it's silly, but it cracks me up.
But that's a unique experience. You don't hear many people talking about. Yeah,
it cracks me up. And when I didn't write that. I just discovered it one night on stage. and it cracks me up. And it's so silly. I'm surprised every time that the audience laughs so hard at it too, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's just so silly.
That show we did last week was incredible. Eliza Schlesinger opened. And then you went on.
Oh, at
it was like an open mic night.
At a cottage.
Bergen Steakhouse.
Yeah.
And then you went on.
And then Ali Wong went on.
And then
on,
Ali
right?
Wong went on working on new material. I had to go on after Ali Wong.
Yeah. How was that?
I had a great set, but yeah. I was surprised I had a great set because, you know, after you have an orgasm, you don't want to keep having sex.
Yeah.
It seemed like the audience had already peaked.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like here's all these wonderful women crushing it.
Yeah.
And, but no, I ended up having a great set.
I find with those shows, I learned this at like the, when I first started working the Cellar, SD would have me host a couple of shows. And even if I wasn't hosting, I would like be fearful of like going on, you know, it's at the time where like, Chappelle could drop in, Louis C.K. could drop in, Seinfeld, Chris Rock, anybody could drop. And it's like, and you got to do your spot after them.
Yeah.
You know? And I would be like so scared. Even to go up after some people who are like, you know, as much as like the world doesn't know them, they're so seasoned and you know how much the audience is going to enjoy them, like a Tony Woods or a Greer Barnes or, you know?
Yeah.
And then I would be like so scared to go up after them. And then I remember Greer told me one time, I was like, I do not want if I hate following you. And he was like, go do your shit. Don't worry about nobody else.
Yeah.
Do your shit. And you realize like, oh, they're in such a good mood. Everybody likes a cherry on top. Everybody. You know?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't, to use your analogy, I wouldn't think of it like, oh, you know, after you orgasm, nobody wants sex, but they do like to cuddle.
That's true.
Let me be your cuddler.
I'm the cuddler. I went on at the Cellar once. This is like 98, 99. After Chris Rock, it was the first time he had hosted the Oscars, and you know he's you know hometown hero, mm-hmm. New Yorker. He got a standing O.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he bumped me. He wasn't even on the lineup. He got a standing O. Walking out there,
mm-hmm.
and then he did like I don't know, like half hour destroyed, mm-hmm. had him eating out of his hands the whole mm-hmm. time, and then they gave him a standing O when he left,
mm-hmm.
and then I had to go on after him, and like I go Chris Rock, ladies and gentlemen, a bona fide superstar, mm-hmm. Mr. Chris Rock,
mm-hmm.
wow, did you see him host the Oscars? That was incredible. I watched the Oscars eating a tuna fish sandwich in my underwear, which was true. But yeah, those are that's when you're really got to be a fighter pilot and not lose your cool.
Yeah. Don't. I mean, yeah, it's not that. Also, too, you realize it's not like a taping. It's not a competition.
Yeah.
You know, when you do these shows, like showcase shows, a lot of times it can feel like a competition, you know, like can I be as funny as that person was? Or, and it's really not.
Yeah. Do you have any questions for me?
No, not really. Okay. Have you enjoyed this conversation?
Very much so. I've been looking forward to recording with you forever, you know?
Yeah.
I just find you such a wonderful, interesting person.
Thank you.
And I love your comedy.
Thank you. I'm glad we got to do this. Yeah, I'm super glad.
What do you think of the Rhodes Library?
I am quite impressed. I mean, I must say that I don't think that I had any expectation in what your place would look like, but I definitely did not expect this.
Okay. What do you think? There'd be like...
I didn't think anything.
An old couch.
No, I didn't think anything. That's the thing. I didn't think anything, but I definitely didn't think this, but I like it. I could never live like this. Why? It's so much.
Yeah.
It's so much. It would be overwhelming for me. I'm really like simple because I can get overwhelmed really easy. So I have to keep things very simplistic. Mm-hmm. But this is, I love this for you. I really do. I'm so impressed with it. When I see it, it's like, to me, it shows like your life, you know? Most spaces, my space, when you walk in, you're not going to see you're not going to see a big, you know, you might not know I ever traveled anywhere, right, unless I tell you. But the moment I walk in here, I'm like, oh, he's been everywhere.
Mine's in National Geographic.
Yeah, he's been everywhere.
I bought these blankets in Mexico.
Yeah. He's read everything. He's listened to everything. You know, yeah. I think that that's wonderful. You heard me when I walked in. I said, you have two money trees.
I do have two money
Not trees. One, two.
So I'm waiting for the money to start coming in.
It'll come.
Yeah.
It'll come. But thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And I'm always cheering for you, Zainab.
Thank you.
And I'm always happy when I see that we're on the same shows together, you know?
Yeah.
And I love your voice, love the things that you say, and the way you express yourself comedically.
Thank you.
In closing, is there any words of advice or words of wisdom that you'd like to give to the people of the earth?
I always said, I'm just going to say this real quick. I remember when I first met you, I was like, do you do voiceovers? Remember I asked you that?
Oh, yeah.
You have to do voiceovers.
I wish somebody would. I don't have an agent.
You have to, because your voice is so distinct.
I would love to do
voiceovers. It's so distinct. And you have this accent that I just can't even place.
Good.
It's like
that's how I think about your accent. Like, to me, it's not New York, but you say it is. But like... your voice to me just sounds like educated North American. There's not like, I don't hear any Minnesota. I don't hear New York. I don't hear, you know, it's interesting. You just have a lovely
speaker.
Even
when I'm like talking, like,
oh, well,
like,
now you say talk, but I never heard you say like talk before. That was good.
I guess because I'm not using that, you never hear me say like talk, but that's how I say talk. Or if I say like water or something like that, like, okay, that's very New York to me.
All right, now you're throwing them out there. All right.
I guess it's certain words. I don't know. Sometimes when I listen to myself too, I'm just like, you know, because I speak like with a lot of slang too, like it's just in my conversational,
yeah,
you know. So I'm just like, I be, even on stage, it's like, I be, ain't, I'm like the girl, oh my God, this is what you sound like. Words of wisdom, words of advice.
Anything that might,
I do think that, only one, I always say to most people, don't take yourself too seriously, you know? Don't take yourself too seriously.
You know, seriousness for a comedian is like arthritis.
Yeah, I'm super serious, actually.
I can be overly serious.
Yeah, like, one of my younger brothers was in the green room with me last night. And like I said, they all think they're funnier than me. And something about being around me and being in my comedy setting, they feel like they need to perform. And my brother is like, do you need anything from me right now? I said, I need you to be quiet. He was like, really? I said, yeah. He said, you need to get an entourage. I said, no, I said, you don't understand. I like quiet. I like peace and quiet before I get up on stage.
Yeah.
You know, I like it to, when I'm in my house, I like it to be quiet. I don't want to hear anything. And he was like, oh, my bad, sit, you know? So I can be rather serious sometimes. But I would say to everybody out there, like, don't take yourself too seriously, you know? Don't take yourself too seriously and just, you know, forgive yourself. We're only human.
Forgive yourself for not forgiving yourself sooner.
Yeah. And also, you know, find reasons to laugh. Like, this is so cliche, but I do believe it. It's like laughter is a really potent medicine. So, you know, try to laugh.
I agree. Yeah. Zainab, I love you so much. Thank you for coming over today. Long may you run, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for the tea, too. This was great.
It was lovely to have a tea and conversation with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Hooray for humanity.
Tom Rhodes, you're a funny man. Tom Rhodes, you're an international comedian. Tom Rhodes, karate kick, baby. Oh, yeah. You're a groovy dude. You go all around the world telling jokes to all of the people. You are an international comedian. You're funny to everybody in every single country in the world. Tom Rhodes, I like you very much. I think you're talented and very wonderful. Tom Rhodes, you're the best guy in the world. I wanna be your friend, you should call me sometime. Here is my phone number, 603-644-0048. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tom Rhodes, you're an international comedic sensation. Tom Rhodes, I like to listen to your podcast. Tom Rhodes, you're the best man to ever walk on the earth.